Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to episode number 36 of the Free Cities Podcast. Well, I hope that you're enjoying the summer thus far. Here in Wales, where I am, well, we had our summer in late May, as usual, and now, as we do each year, we spend our days learning to appreciate the rain until such a time that it begins turning back into sleet again, and we know that the balmy days of summer are over. Well, on the podcast this week, it's all sunny. As promised, I'm back with Titus Gable for another conversation, and the subject of our discussion is medieval city-states. Titus is, of course, very knowledgeable on governance models from this time in history, and we spend our time exploring the rise and fall of free imperial city models and what it might have been like to live under such a system, as well as discussing what, if any, lessons we may be able to learn from these historical free cities in order to apply them to their modern day incarnations. Anyway, I'll keep this intro brief. Don't forget to like and subscribe to the Free Cities Podcast. Any questions or suggestions can be directed to myself via our usual social media channels. And if you still haven't got your tickets to our yearly Free Cities get-together in Prague, then get yourself over to libertyinourlifetime.org and join in the most exciting movement on the planet right now. Finally, of course, it just leaves for me to say, create a peaceful space for yourself, shut out the world, sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Titus Gable. Okay, so Titus is back, as promised, because I want a lesson in medieval city-states.
Yeah.
I'll tell you the reason first, because amongst other things, it's a conversation that I seem to keep having, and I'd like some information to draw upon so that I can sort of engage in the conversation mm-hmm. more. And, you know, like, I think one of my main questions is, what was it like to live in a medieval city state? Mm-hmm. How did you, like, could you leave and come back as you wanted? Did you travel much? Was this a time when people didn't travel a lot, or, you know, and I've heard people say that there were tolls to pay on every time you went yeah. through it. You know, like, mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. tell me, describe life in a medieval city state, according to what you know.
Yeah. I mean, I've read a lot about medieval cities. I would say it's not really city states. You had few city states like Venice or so, but most medieval cities were autonomous cities that had the emperor above them, or they had guaranteed rights, so they were not fully states, right? But they had a high level of autonomy resulting from the fact that they, especially the so-called free imperial cities, they had dissolved themselves from the monarchies that originally were the territorial rulers, and had managed to be just under the rule of the emperor. But you have to know that at that time, the Holy Roman Empire had a leader who was elected by the other monarchs, by the dukes and grand dukes. He had no standing army. He had to beg the other monarchs for money if he wanted to wage war. There was very few institutions on central level. There was a main court, and there was a kind of an assembly, and there was no standing administration, no police. So that means if you are an imperial, free imperial city, you're actually on your own, right? But nevertheless, the word state is not justified for the medieval cities because they had nowhere no sovereigns and they were not negotiating with other sovereign states. There are some few exceptions. Venice became an independent city-state over time. So did Ragusa. But most of the cities in Italy and in Germany, they remained under the sovereignty of the Holy Roman Empire. So just to make it clear, right? Because today we have real city-states like Monaco and Singapore, but we have a lot of cities that are not really independent, but have also kind of city-state character, like Hong Kong, which is under sovereignty of China, and Dubai, which is under the high sovereignty of the United Arabian Emirates, right? So, and in the medieval times, it was a little bit so that they were de facto independent, but not official sovereign. So that means there was no president or something like that. But it's coming back to your question, how was life like? I can give you what I have got from all the books that I read when writing my own book about the medieval time. And there was a very important aspect. It's called in German Stadtluft macht frei, and that translates into city air makes you free. And it's a little bit strange. What does this mean? And that means that you were, as when you were living in rural areas, in some areas you were basically owned by your ruler, right? And you had to make some work once a week and stuff like that. And to escape that, I think, I don't know the English technical term for that, but if you as kind of a serfdom, right? But if you manage to escape and were not caught again for 1 year and 1 day, then you were considered a free man. And so what happened is that people, they run away from their rulers and hide in the cities and did not leave the city for a year and a day, and then thereby becoming free. And that is the reason why, of course, it's not the air of the city that makes you free, right? But this saying is still existing in German language, but few people do understand what it means, right? And also, if people want to describe a long period, they say nach Jahr und Tag, after year and day, and people do not understand why they say it.
We I think in English we say a year and a day as well.
Probably that was also popular in Europe, right? So that this is a kind of a term where people say, okay, this is one of our rules, right? You can go after your service, but not after year and a day, because there has to be an end to that. It's a little bit like if you commit a crime, a small crime, and then say after 3 or 5 years, well, basically
null and void.
Yeah.
So, okay, I still want a bit of a description, but I've got some questions.
I can go on, but
no, can we just come back to that? Yeah. I had a couple of thoughts when you were speaking there. Number one is, in the time of the free imperial cities, if the central government or whoever it was,
the emperor,
had no standing army and no, what were you getting from this central body? What was the benefit of you know, how did the free imperial city benefit from this relationship?
Well, it did not. I mean, the point was,
did they pay
the empire? Tithes? Empire was first, right? And it was the Holy Roman Empire. Of course, it wasn't. It was basically the Germanic barbarians taking over Rome and then declaring themselves, "We are now the successors, and we call ourselves the Holy Roman Empire." And only later they added, "Well, the Holy Roman Empire of German nation," and it is a kind of the idea that the emperor was always normally fighting with the pope, but the pope was the one who crowned the empire, and the emperor said he was sent from God, and people believed that, right? And then over time, the more, I would say, powerful local dukes and grand dukes and monarchs, or even kings, they wanted to have a say, and they wanted to also have a say in who is becoming the emperor, which was normally one of them, right? So there were amongst the monarchs in the Holy Roman Empire, there was also the two-class society. You had the monarchs that were entitled to elect the emperor and the others. But even the others had their own principalities or whatever, where there was basically they were the rulers. The whole emperor thing is only, okay, we are more powerful and we can assemble a bigger army if we are sticking together under the leadership of the emperor. And that was like you see in the movies where the emperor was asking who is giving me soldiers, right? How many, right? Like in Game of Thrones. That was reality in medieval Europe. The emperor was begging for money and for soldiers to wage war against whoever.
Right? And did they pay tax or tithes or whatever?
No.
So the free imperial cities were really independent.
They had the same status after hundreds of years of fighting. They had basically the same status as a monarch, as a prince. They were directly under the emperor. And there was one thing, because there was no capital in the Holy Roman Empire, so there was another obligation. If the emperor was basically traveling around all the time, and he had some fixed points, like in Aachen, right? And when he was traveling around, that it was the obligation of all princes, of all cities, of everyone, to feed him and his people, right? Which was unwanted because it costed money, but nobody doubted that obligation because he had no capital. Interesting concept. But that concept, by the way, which is very decentralized, no strong central power, lasted for 1,000 years. This is definitely something you can say, okay, if something lasted for 1,000 years, they must have something right.
Yeah.
Must have done something right.
Yeah. So as a side question, are there still families that originated from these cities that are powerful families now? I take it the cities were run... No, maybe I should ask that question first. Yeah. Who ran the cities?
It came all from the business people and traders. That I looked up how this started in Cologne. Cologne was one of the biggest cities in the medieval times. It dated back to Roman times. So it was a city founded by the Romans, and after the Roman Empire collapsed, it survived, and then after the Dark Ages, it still flourished a bit, right? And then it was part of the Archbishop of Cologne and region. And the bishops at that time were like princes, right? They had an army. They were basically the leader. And in that time, they were still around the year, I looked it up, in the year 1074, there was a first known uprising riot in Cologne, because the merchants of Cologne were treated badly by the archbishop and in an unjust way. It's not fully clear what happened, but that is in the books. And there was a really uprising in the city. And the archbishop did really use brute force, military force, to suppress this upheaval. And then the next thing we know from Cologne dates 40 years after that, 40, 50 years, they somehow established to finally get their own court for the city, which is independent from the archbishop. And now that is always something which is very important. And at that time, it was especially important for the merchants, which were the thriving force behind all these city projects, because they didn't want to be subject to these religious judgments and people fire probes and these really strange esoteric or mythical stuff. They were business people, right? There's a civil law issue, and this is really was a big point in many cities, that we want commercial courts, right, and not these religious courts with coming with strange mechanisms. And they got it. Against the will of the, or somewhat against the will of the archbishop, he had to make some concessions, right? So it's another 50 years later, we hear that they finally could establish the city council against the will of the archbishop, where they could at least make some decisions. So over this time, 150 years, they were permanently trying to regulate their own affairs in a way that better fits their needs. And the thriving forces behind all that were the merchants. And because the cities were marketplaces, and the market is not as we maybe today we say there's a market in Cologne, and we mean it's a place called the market. The markets in that time were only happening from time to time. And it is so that the city says we are entertaining a market, and the market was going on for 2-3 weeks or so. And then merchants from all other the region were coming. It was word spread around. There's a market in Cologne, so that everybody was coming. And there were special market rules necessary because people were coming from other principalities, from other lands and countries. And normally, even the monarchs, like the archbishop, they were given guarantees saying, if there's a market, we will protect you. And at the beginning of the market, there was a special court elected out of the merchants that were participating in the market for all these commercial disputes that may arise during that time. And other monarchs gave guarantees that if somebody was robbed during the market, they would pay him damages, right? So to get people gathering there. And that perpetuated in the bigger cities like Cologne over time, so that there were standing courts, and which were accepted by the archbishop, the merchants again say, we want basically different rules than the rest of you. So it's a kind of a special economic zone, version 1.0, right? They say we need commercial rules that differ from the normal rules. And eventually the merchants in the cities became, because cities are denser and just have more productivity because more people are exchanging and we have infrastructure there. So they were becoming so powerful that they say, hey, by the way, we don't need the principality at all. We have a permanent market, but we want to live according to our rules that are best for us merchants. Still, 90% of the population had nothing to do with those rules and leadership of the city. So in the case of Cologne, it is then we've heard that after 150 years after the first upheaval, uprising, there was an independent city council which could make some decisions, but it was still under the sovereignty of the archbishop, which was still unwanted. And it was 50 years later that, with the help of another neighboring prince, they beat the archbishop on the military field, right, and kicked him out of the city. And that was in the year 1288. And since then, Cologne is governing themselves, right? But of course, they lost it then again when the German Empire, the Second German Empire, was established in 1871. But it's a long time, right? But it took them 200 years. And they were one of the first cities to do that, because they were one of the first existing cities in what is today Germany. And So it took them 200 years, right, to get rid of this leadership and become independent. But then happened something that other cities were following, and it was much quicker than happening, and more cities were coming to existence over those years in the early Middle Ages, and they all copied that get rid of your prince type. And then interestingly, I don't know when exactly, but the heydays were around 1300, 1400. Then it flipped around. Then suddenly the monarchs recognized it's good to have a powerful city because of the economic effects that also lifting up the whole surrounding land. And then they started to offer people land to found new cities and guaranteed that they were independent and only under the leadership of the emperor. And so this is an interesting development. And then you had this Cambrian explosion of independent cities where there were several hundreds in Central Europe.
Question about the markets.
Yes.
Are you talking about a sort of market for commodities, or are you talking about a market in the sense that we think of a market, a massive area where people are selling just everything?
Yes, they're selling everything. There are two types of markets. So one is the people selling everything, like today they're selling fruits, they were selling all kinds of clothes, they were selling everything. But the other type of market is a specialized market. In the city where I come from, a small city, which was also, by the way, independent, but had only, I don't know, at that time, maybe 1,000 inhabitants. They had a borer market, which it's like a drilling machine, borers, right? Mm-hmm. And this is still celebrated today. The market has long disappeared, but the name has remained. It's now it's more entertaining thing for a week. But that gives you the impression, okay, what? How did it work? It was once a year, it was for 1 week, and was only for one product. So everybody who was producing borers, drillers, was knowing that in the city of Neckargemünd, in that case, they were coming together once a year. So that if you needed something like that, you had to wait until the next market was happening. So in other cities like Cologne, I think there was market where everything was sold, right? And then you had, of course, horse markets and cattle markets and all kinds of things. But I was surprised that such a, I would say, secondary device as a borer, right? They had an own market for that.
Well, there weren't as many products back then, were there?
Well, you know. Yeah, but it is interesting that... at least there were markets, so there must be a demand for such things, and this is basically, I would say, rather B2B business, right? Mm.
Yeah.
And interesting, people underestimate how much economic activity happened in the Middle Ages, because we have this idea that, yeah, there was a Roman Empire was going down, and there was just dark ages until the inventing the steam machine, right? That's not true. The people invented a lot of stuff in the Middle Ages. They created a bank account system in northern Italy, right? And they came up with tremendous inventions in the mining sector in Germany and smelters and all that. For example, Martin Luther, his father, was a quite successful smelting master for copper. So he knew how to separate copper from the rock by melting it. So he was a smelter and get some wealth out of that, right? And he could finance Martin Luther's theological university studies. And that is giving you some hints that, okay, what was the economy at that time? And it's not that they were all just praying all day long and working on the field to make some grains, right? But there was an industry for the mining sector and metal making already, which you can really call an industry. And it's only one guy called Agricola who was a doctor And his real name was Bauer, which means farmer, but the Latin version sounds more noble, so he called himself Agricola. And he wrote a book about all the inventions in the mining sector, and without him we would not know that, because these people they are not appearing in history books. It's because it's profound commerce, right? Because our historians are also people who have not enough contact to the real world and to the real markets. For me, these people are heroes who have developed out of wood large mills. If you tread them, you can get water out of the mines, right? And other things where you're saying, hey, this is tremendous. Or the cranes, right, which they developed into the... To unload ships, and all these are totally unknown who invented that, and they were not praised at that time either, because the good thing is if you are a priest or a king or a prince and nobility and don't have nothing to do with this profane money making and business. That was over all the Middle Ages. If you were designing an altar for a church, your name was known. Yeah. If you were inventing a new machine that would enable people to increase the output of the copper mines, and everybody would have more metal pieces and raise the whole standard of living, nobody would even want to know your name. Right, and that was really, really hundreds and hundreds of years. But in reality, the merchants became more powerful because they were producing something that people were looking for. And especially with trade, the problem was indeed that we had too many different rules and too many different tolls. And the merchants said, hey, if we want really to make business, we have to kind of have a special rules, and that was accepted. So they got their special market rules, and over time that fortified into an alliance which was called Hanseatic League, where they said, okay, the merchants, we want to have these rules, and we want to have it in other cities as well.
Didn't that include weights and measures as well? They were all different, weren't they?
They were all different, and they still remained different.
But the Hanseatic League didn't create one weight and measure.
That's a good question. I don't know that, but I think I would know if they would, because I know that when the Second German Empire was established in 1871, it took another 10 years to harmonize all these different weights and measures. So obviously there wasn't something like that before. But probably the Hanseatic people, they had maybe some agreed on something, or they knew, like we know, okay, dollar, euro exchange rate. Probably had that in their minds.
And the markets, are you saying that there weren't many markets for your average citizen to trade, or as in fresh fruit and veg and that kind of stuff, or they were in existence as well? This is just...
Yeah, I think this was the way to deal in the Middle Ages, right? You just open either your shop or sell what you were harvesting from the field. These bigger markets were for more elevated products, like clothes, like metal tools and stuff like that. But I think in cities there was for the food and there's a daily market like today.
That's what I thought. Yeah. And all right, I think using Cologne as an example is quite good. Did Cologne, when it was a free imperial city, have a wall all the way around it and entry and exit points?
Absolutely. So this is, I would say every city that was not totally small had a wall around it. And this is another thing. If you have a powerless or limited power emperor, that there are regional wars going on all the time, right? And the advantage of having city walls is that before you had a wall, then there were just armies of principalities, and they were hired mercenaries or whatever. And yeah, often the prince couldn't pay the mercenaries, and then told them, you just loot the city, right? Instead of me paying you, you can keep what you get there. And the cities, they wanted to protect themselves, of course, against that, because that's also a human constant thing, that if you are rich and the neighbors are not, then they might get the idea to take it away from you. Right. And so far, it's until today that rich city states like Monaco and Singapore, they have a particular effort in security. And Cologne, as all the cities, they had a big wall. And in absence of a standing army, there was an obligation for the people in the city to defend the city. So they had a clear roles, right? So if you were living in a certain quarter, you know, this is the part of the wall where I have to go in case of an attack. And then the bells were rung in the churches, you know, okay, there's something happening. And then doors were closed, they were all manning the walls, and this was pre-organized. The advantage of that is they didn't have to pay for a standing army, right? They had maybe a small force that was standing. And but in war, the idea was simple. We have big walls and we have enough food reserves for a year or two. That was a big advantage for the defender from a technological standpoint. That made cities, they could remain independent because it was easier to defend than to attack. And that's kept so that remained so for a very long time. And that is always the case if you have a military technology which enables the attacker to be, like later the guns, or the first guns were not really effective against meter thick walls, but later if the guns were becoming better and better, then the city wall was not really protection enough, and then also these cities disappeared, or they became part of the principalities or the countries again.
And did they have any way of knowing who was coming in and out?
Yeah, there is no. I mean, this is certainly so that they had a special, and you know this because today these names are still there. They have doors. They have or ports, and they had normally not only one, like a castle, but they had in each direction one. So they had four bigger cities like Cologne, probably had eight entry points. And every entry point there was a guard, right? And I don't know exactly how they did it, but I know that many cities didn't want poor people to be in the city, even not as a worker. So they were allowed to work, but they had to leave the city again. And then other people who wanted to settle permanently in the city, they were really competing for people, because in the Middle Ages, especially after the the pest, you know, this big illness that killed one third of the plague killed one third of the population. So they were all competing for qualified, skilled people, and they were offering all kinds of things. But unqualified people were not wanted, right? So they were tolerated, and then you could come and maybe hide, because there was no digital surveillance, right? So if you were in the city and would hide, then probably you could be there. But what they did said, okay, you can become a member of the city, but you have to pay something as an entry fee, because we built all the walls and this, right? And so people had to pay if they want to become permanent resident or citizen of Cologne, for example. And I think if there were people coming in with wagons and things to sell, that wasn't a problem for the guards. It was just beggars, right? They would be refused beggars at the gates.
And what about buying property then? So say you're mm-hmm. someone decided, right, Cologne's my city. You get to the front gate, The guard says, "What's your business? I actually want to come and live here."
Yeah.
What do they do? Like, who do they go to? Do they have to buy?
No, I think the city council would make the rules, right? They would say, "Okay, we are in need of we want to grow, right? And then let's attract population." They would send people out, shouting, "The city of Cologne is looking for new residents," right? With a drum, somebody. Yeah. But yeah, how you see it in the movies. But it is certainly so that there was were procedures how to approach, and the city council was the decisive body, and they would say, okay, if you want to become member of our city, then you have to tell us what is your profession, and we may not need some professions, which is still the case today in Monaco, for example. They ask you, what is your profession? How do you make a living? And if you say, I want to be a lawyer or a real estate broker, they say, no, we have enough. You can't do that, right? So you have to come with other. And probably that was the same there, right? And then they say, okay, you have to pay something as an entry fee, or if we are in urgent need of people like you, we skip that entry fee. And normally, how did they make money? You had to pay a toll if you were importing, exporting things, selling things. Sometimes transactions, you would then apply for, I want to buy a house or whatever, and then you would have to pay something. But this differed from city to city.
So the private property rights are the same as we see now. Some people were landlords, some people owned, there's a market for...
Yeah, and the most cities were ruled by the elites, right, of course, which were merchants and owners and property owners. And over time, then, the same happened with the emperor, that the smaller monarchs also want to have a say who is becoming the emperor, and the same happened in the cities. So the number of people who wanted to decide about a city council, that also increased. And we have seen this before in ancient Greek city-states. And the downside to that is that they came up with all kinds of taxes and all kinds of redistribution things. And you have to be careful if you were a wealthy person in some cities, that they wouldn't just come up with any ridiculous claim and get you, seize you of your property. So these were the downsides of an ever increasing, I think, electorate. But for hundreds of years, it was in the German cities was really the merchants, not so much families as in Italian cities. You have famous Medici family running Florence and over hundreds of years. This is, again, I mean, if you have several hundred cities, then you do not have one system to govern the city. But in principle, this democratic idea that there's a city council which is elected, and the city council then elects or nominates a mayor or something like that, that is kind of the standard model until today. Right?
Another question about the physical structure of these cities. Was there land available in these cities, or were they pretty built up and the wall was enclosing just buildings?
Yeah,
you couldn't buy a bit of land and build something yourself. There was no space.
No. If you look at the old towns that we have today, they're extremely dense, right? And that is because the room was limited after you built the wall.
Yeah.
Then so there were no parks or stuff like that. And of course, there were cities which had land which were growing and then were building the wall. But the problem was actually only you had, for I think most time of the medieval times, you had only to choose between buying an apartment or a small or expensive house in the city, or buying a house, tear it down, buy a bigger house in the city at a high price, or get outside of the gates and build something there. And this problem was only overcome in the 18th century, when they were tearing down the city walls to grow, right? Because that was a problem for a very long time.
How does the city of London fit into this? Because, you know,
Bishopsgate, Aldgate.
They had the gates of the City of London. Exactly, the same. And this is not a different... This is a development that you've seen all over the place. An interesting thing about the City of London is that the Hanseatic League, they even had a warehouse there. In this warehouse, there were the Hanseatic League, whatever, Lübeck, whatever they agreed to, was applicable, and not the law of the City of London. So this is also kind of a, today we would say it's a special economic zone for Hanseatic traders, and that was it. So at that time, and this is another misconception of the Middle Ages, is that they were just all totally isolated in their villages and behind their walls. No, they were trading with all the known world, that was other European cities and depending where they are, the successful Italian cities, of course, the Mediterranean trade with the Ottoman Empire. Eventually, Indian goods were coming and stuff like that. But even in the Hanseatic League was a trader association first and foremost, and they traded with no matter what country, what religion, what nationality. All over the place. Well, religion, they were all Christian, right? But they were different factions, but they didn't care. They did care about
interestingly,
that.
Interestingly, I worked in London for 7 years as a journalist, and the city of the Corporation of London had its own police force, the old City of London, because we were forever coming in contact with them. They were a different breed. That's basically everything within the old city walls.
Yeah, and these are remnants from the old times, definitely. I mean, Bishopsgate alone shows you, okay, there were more than one gate. Otherwise, yes, it wouldn't be a necessity to name them. And there was a wall, yes, right? And and then you have, I think, still until today, they have some special rights. These were the original city rights from the City of London, which was a small area compared to today's London.
The guilds too. Like my school was I went to a school which was owned by the Skinners Company,
yeah,
which were the people that skinned, you know, the guild hall is where all the guilds of all the traders, you know.
Yeah, and this was together. Also one of the downsides of the basically unlimited regulatory power of the city council, that they came up with these guild ideas, right? So everybody who's making shoes must be in the same road. Yeah. And if your father is a shoemaker, you can become a shoemaker, but not a tailor. And today we say stupid stuff like that was the reality for hundreds and hundreds of years. On the other hand, people say, no, these guilds were there before. And one of the reasons that people in the cities wanted to get rid of their princes and dukes was that they were regulated anything, right? So how to dress, how much to eat for your wedding, and how many meals a day you can have, and things. They were really going deeply into your private life, today we would say. But I mean, what you can see now in today's world is neo-feudalistic tendencies to regulate again what people eat, how they speak, and this is all has been there before, and this was one of the reasons why the city people, they just wanted to get rid of these stupid regulations, make our own stupid regulations instead.
Yeah. So what talk about the decline of the medieval city states, or what was the reason that they declined according to you?
It's the race of the modern nation state. Weaponry plays a role, then standing armies, a better administration. Actually, it was Napoleon who was the deadly blow for most of the German cities, and I mean, and also Italian cities, because the Holy Roman Empire ended 1806 when Napoleon forced the last emperor, which was also the king of Austria-Hungary, to abdicate. A 1,000-year history was coming to an end, and with it, many of the, not all, but many of the independent cities, or
de facto independent cities. And Napoleon was basically just raising it and saying, okay, we make a new map, right? There are too many different entities in the Holy Roman Empire. Out of 2,000, we make it, say, 130. And that means all the smaller cities were given to the princes. Only the bigger, like Frankfurt, Lübeck, Hamburg, Bremen, they remained independent entities within then Napoleon's satellite state, and then later was called the German Bund, before then the German Second Empire was established. And I think a lot of big cities came to an end at that time. Venice was also captured by Napoleon in 1797, came to an end, never came back. And that was just... if you can mobilize large armies with modern weapons, have a standing army, have standing taxation, then the advantage of the cities that can easily defend themselves was lost, and their meaning was also lost, because it was a powerful player and people would say, hey, maybe I'd rather become part of this powerful empire than this small city. And yeah, this... Their time was just over.
There must be some important lessons to be learnt then. And what I mean is, in the current free cities model, which has much in common with the medieval cities model, what lessons can we learn from the demise of those states to how modern contemporary free cities might work and might mitigate the same issues that caused them to fail?
Okay, I think one of the positive lessons we can take away from the medieval city states is that you should guarantee certain rights and establish a rule of law and independent courts to give the not only the merchants but all residents legal stability. And then the other thing is, do not spend too much on defense, but be capable of defend yourself to a certain degree, or have allies that are helping you. Because without any defense potential, probably it's difficult. But it's not necessary that you do it, that you oblige all the citizens to defend the city. But if you have the right to bear arms and you have allies, like the people of Cologne had an allied prince that helped them throw out the archbishop. That is very important. So diplomacy is very important. The other thing is, don't spend too much money on the penal system. They had all basically... One of the main things, what they would just banish criminals, right? They wouldn't feed them 30 years in prison or so, because that would also be then, if you're stealing from the people in the city and then and consume it, and then the city people say, okay, you have stolen this money from us and eaten it, and now we are paying another 30 years for you. They would say you're crazy, right? But that's what we are doing today. And this is something where we can maybe learn something from the city states, that if you misbehave, then you have to go. It's also positive selection and a deterrence for other people to behave well. I think the downside where we should be careful is to establish a council that has unlimited powers to regulate. That is not ending well. And in so far, we should really limit the administration, the governance of the city to the basic stuff like protection of life, liberty, and property, providing some infrastructure, having independent dispute resolution systems, but do not interfere in the private sphere and life of the people. How can we cope with what brought the old cities to fall? This is big empires, big nation states. The only answer I have to this is alliances with other cities, with other friendly governments, and create a certain certain weight. And on the other hand, you must say that cities like Venice, right? So single city was in the 16th century had the most powerful fleet, both naval and trading fleet of the world, right? So a city that has a lot of economic potential, they will eventually have also some military potential. And the interesting thing about what Venice, we can learn from the city of Venice, is that with a diplomacy and with not interfere in political and religious conflicts that their neighbors are fighting, they survived for 1100 years without a single government was overthrown. And they had one of their leading figures at that time said, "We had powerful enemies, the Pope and the Habsburg Empire, the Austro-Hungarian, France and Ottoman Empire, whatever you name it at that time. And we never lost a single life of one of our fellow citizens. Why? Because we paid money for mercenaries from other countries, right? And I mean, this is something... I see it coming, right? If you look at today's world, the nation states are more and more reluctant to sacrifice the life of their own people. So they're hiring mercenary groups, private like Wagner or Blackwater or all that. This is something where we probably will see some revival of things that were there in the past and hopefully also independent cities.
Well, unfortunately, the hiring of mercenaries in the future might be just robots, droids, you know, the ultimate mercenary would be something like that.
Yeah.
Almost certainly. I mean, as you were speaking, I was thinking about the overthrow, like you said, the overthrow of the old states was just the might of the old city states was the might of the larger state coming in. Mm. And I'm thinking in another 100 years, what is the might? Like, who knows what kind of political battles are going to be fought and how they're going to be fought, because we're already reaching the point where the arms race is becoming a bit futile, because no one wants to use any of these arms anymore. It's not like cannons and, you know, and muskets and stuff. You can destroy everything now.
I mean, we have wars, right? They're not using nukes, but they still do make war. Like the Russia has attacked Ukraine and not using nukes, and probably will not do it. But there's still potential for war with a conventional way. And this will probably not go away so quickly. But I think you're in principle right. There's a tendency that not to make big wars because they're very expensive and it's reputational wise it's not good. And the people, in today's world, you cannot just say people, hey, we are the good and they are the bad. I mean, they try this, but and many people don't buy it, right? So you have many people in Russia just fleeing conscription, even in Ukraine. People do not want to fight for their government, actually, or their political ideas. And I think the tendency we had in the Middle Ages that in cities or whatever, even free villages that were directly under the emperor, right, in Franconia near Schweinfurt. And so the interesting thing is that people like us, we want to be also more independent, more making our own decisions, a little bit like the people in the Middle Ages don't want the archbishop to decide what's happening in the city. We want to have our own decision-making process. And now it's one step further. I don't want the city council to tell me what to do. So I wanted to make my own decisions, but I need somebody to protect me. So because of division of labor, I could protect myself, but it doesn't make sense from an economic standpoint. So if I hire somebody who is doing that, it's better. So that is the next step. We say, in a way, it's comparable to the Middle Ages. In a way, it's a little bit going further, saying we're creating entities that are based on as a service provider for the needs of the people. No more need for majority decision, because also this is a dangerous thing, because it can backfire, so that they're coming up with all kinds of regulations which are strangulating yourself. And then we have again that people do not buy those collectivist things like we have all to stay together and fight against the other group. More and more people just say, I mean, I know history, that is normally nothing that we profit from. And that was even so in the before the Second World War, right? You might have heard that First World War, all people were cheering and saying, hey, finally something is happening, right? Not so in the Second World War. They had this experience and it wasn't very popular. And even in Nazi Germany, they didn't make too much fuss about it. They said, yeah, we're just defending ourselves. And I think that it was Hermann Göring, the Nazi number two after Hitler at that time. He said, well, what is the best outcome of a normal soldier out of a war, that is he's coming back without bad injuries. That's the best case. And therefore war is not popular. And therefore we have to make all kind of propaganda things around. But I think there are enough people today that they do not want that. And I think Russia is a good example. I mean, you would have thought that there's a lot of patriotism, nationalism in Russia. They have the media in their hand and they can influence the people in saying, we are not attacking Ukraine, we are defending us against the West or whatever. But still, people don't want to be conscripted, right? And they were fleeing the country in big numbers. And I mean, this is a sign that I think the same would happen in China if they could escape, because people do not want to die for other people's ideas. And I think it's a bit leading to a world where people want to choose under which regime they are living. And that means, in my view, we will see, hopefully, in 100 years, a big variety of different entities that are states, semi-sovereign entities, or whatever, like in the Middle Ages, where in the Holy Roman Empire, 2,000 different forms of a sovereign, whatever, right, or semi-sovereign, and all kinds of methods. And the good thing is, if you were dissatisfied, you just move 5 kilometers away, and then you have a better regime. The bad thing was you had to pay taxes, or you had to pay tolls and duties all the time. But you can skip that, right? You can say it's a common trade zone, and then you have to. All these criticism against small states of the Middle Ages is because of this. They have different measures, and they you have to pay duties each time you cross the border. But you can cope with that, right? You can use the same measures, and you can say we are not charging any duties. And then you have solved the problem, and then suddenly the beautiful aspects of the small states then come to play.
Final question then. Is there anything we can learn about the size of free cities that we can learn from medieval cities?
Yeah, I think there were no million people cities in medieval times. Or could you have had lesser people on Earth? And of course, but I think it's important that a city is not exceeding a certain size. And if it is, that it's basically then creating a new city. Because in a medieval city, it's not that everybody knew everybody, but there was, you knew your neighbors, you knew your council members personally. You know that your neighbor was standing beside you on the wall, and that one in the block was the sergeant or whatever they call it, either Feldwebel, yeah. And this is a different situation than we have today. I don't think we can definitely come back to the same, that everybody will defend the city stuff. But in a way, well, I was thinking about people who are voluntarily supporting the firefighters, police, or defense forces. They get a deduction of their annual fee or things like that, which is creating also a kind of community, but not forcing people to do something.
Mm. Well, thanks for that. That's fascinating. I feel a lot brighter, wiser than I did an hour ago. Yeah, I just thought of one other question. Oh, that was it. You just mentioned it. So you did pay a yearly fee to be a member of the city. Is that the case?
No. There was one-time fee, relatively often. I heard it for new entrants, because the others said, well, we paid all this construction and you not, so you have to pay something. And then they had also this taxes.
Right. So it was a tax system that paid for
mostly.
The,
yeah, and okay. I heard that in cases of attack where they needed more money, they were putting extra taxes on beverages and food and stuff like that. But there was no, and there was even a kind of wealth tax, but the income tax was not known at the time, right? So it was really that there was more indirect taxes for transactions like importing, exporting goods, or again, in war times, you had a beverage tax, which was then abandoned after the war was
but
over.
No bonds and things like that issued. I mean, the Venetians, not the Venetians, the Italian ones, they kind of started all the central banks, didn't they? So
the banks at all, right? They started banks at all. And they also had a debt system. And I think in Germany, it was Fugger in Augsburg. It was a tremendously successful and powerful and mighty bank, right? He could decide who became emperor, so mighty he was. But the Italians were the first that came up with printed paper bills as a kind of an IOU, right? Yes, that happened there.
But was that a part of the reason why, well, did that make them more powerful? I mean, they were some of the more powerful.
I think if you have a banking system at all that enables you to pay in here and pay out in another city, that is far superior to you put all kinds of coins in a wagon and then truck it to the other city, right? So definitely the invention of banking system made the upper Italian cities very powerful.
Yeah, great. Right. Well, thanks, Titus. It's very informative. I think it's a great subject. It's a really interesting subject. Something I'd never thought about until I bumped into you guys, and it's nice to see that there are at least a few historical examples that we can look back on, because at the moment in the present we've got we don't have a huge amount to draw upon other than theory.
Yeah. And this is important, right? Because if you make you come up with a new idea that has never been tried, never been tested in the what I call the market of living together, then there's a high probability that it is not working, because otherwise it would have been there, right? In a form or another. And what we try to do with the free cities, is especially with the free private city model, is okay, we have service providers. That is a known thing for thousands of years. And we had independent cities, and they were functioning according to a certain model, and they had to be, in a way, profitable, right? Because there was nobody they could lend money from other than their own people. And so far, they had just to be, had to be at least neutral with their expenses, and they had to raise taxes in case of need. So I think we can learn definitely from those examples.
Great. Well, thanks for talking, and I'll think up another subject for another time and we can do one of those. But Titus, thank you very much.
You're welcome.